The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov. I was just wondering about our little topic yesterday about the law of return change. I didn't get much feedback. I don't know if you had feedback.
Interesting.
I was just wondering whether people really don't care much.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because there are certain topics that I've noticed South African and our listeners in particular engage in around Israel, and I don't know that that is one that is one that they're particularly motivated about.
I mean, it's interesting to know why, whether people just feel in the most part that, well, you know, I do qualify under even the revised law of return if I was to need to or want to exercise it. Therefore, I don't really care too much about it. Or maybe people feel that a narrower law of return is better because it limits the number of people who could potentially claim citizenship. In Israel, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are some people who have this really strong identification with the fact that persecution was dished out to people who had one Jewish grandfather as defined by the Nuremberg laws in the former Nazi Germany. And therefore, there is a certain sentiment about, you know, applying the same rule. Certainly that was the case when the law of return was applied in 1970. But perhaps people don't really care that much these days. You know, that was then and this is now. And things have changed. And, you know, we are happy to have the law of return, but maybe it's not quite on the forefront of our radar as things work out right now. Mm. It's interesting. It was an interesting thing. Yes. Just one other thing before we get into the other topics. There's been an outbreak of corona in the Gaza Strip, which is very, very worrying indeed, given the concentration of people. There's a huge lockdown, at least until Sunday. Apparently, two people have died. Some cases were discovered in a refugee camp, which, of course, is very, very closely inhabited. And, you know, there's a lot of people in a very small area. So there is concern also in Egypt and in Israel about the possibility of a major corona outbreak in Gaza. We will be watching that quite carefully to see what happens. Mm.
It is worrying indeed. An Israeli civilian was stabbed to death in a suspected terror attack yesterday. A horrific story. What are the details?
Well, I mean, just, you know, what a crazy story. This took place at the Skula Junction in Petah Tikva. A young man, 39-year-old Shai Ohayun, a father of four, was seemingly attacked at random without any real reason for it and without any motivation. It just seemed to be purely being at the wrong place at the wrong time. A man from the nearby town of Nablus in the West Bank was the person who stabbed him, just simply took out a knife, stabbed him, left him there. By the time the emergency services came, they already found him without a pulse. He was taken to hospital, but unfortunately, there seemed to be no possible way of resuscitating him. And it's not exactly clear whether this can be considered to be a terror attack or not, given that we understand that the suspect, who apparently has no criminal background and held a valid permit to work in Israel as a construction worker, didn't really seem on the radar of the security services at all. There was apparently he had undergone some mental health issues and treatment within the Palestinian Authority health area. But there was still the view that he may have been put up to it by somebody else. In other words, it may well be that he was considered to be sufficiently mentally unstable that somebody else would have given him the idea and put him up to it. It does happen from time to time. So the security services are considering the possibility that it might have been terror related, although the individual himself doesn't seem to have had any real nationalistic motivation. Very, very difficult situation indeed. And of course, unfortunately, four children left without a father, young children, and a family left without a breadwinner as a result of this really unnecessary attack.
Absolutely terrible. Really, really just heartbreaking and so unnecessary and such a waste of life. Israeli Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi is making his first diplomatic trip abroad since taking office. What's the significance of this visit?
Well, I think it is significant. First of all, that anybody's traveling anywhere at all is, I think, significant in itself. Certainly in and out of Israel, there's not a great deal of international travel. There is some. The airport is open. There are flights, but very, very few and not a great deal of international traffic at all. But Gabi Ashkenazi has decided to travel to Germany. He already met with German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Soon after he arrived, and he did thank the German president for recognizing Hezbollah as a terror organization. Finally, this has happened. But what's happening in Germany is that there is a meeting of the EU foreign ministers. And the idea is that Ashkenazi will go along there and have an opportunity to meet, I guess, quite a number of the EU foreign ministers all at one location rather than having to tour around to different capitals and meet government representatives in each country. I think this is just an opportunity to kill a few birds with one stone and meet as many people as he can all at one go. And he has, he will be meeting with the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, as well, who was the person who actually invited him. The German foreign minister invited him to come to the meeting to meet the EU, his EU counterparts on the side, on the edges of this EU conference. What's interesting about Gabi Ashkenazi, of course, that he is a former chief of general staff, so he's got a very, very strong military background. And what's interesting about the Israeli military is that they really come with a sense of determination and responsibility to make good what was lacking during the period of the Shoah. Our soldiers are taught to understand that the Israeli army is the difference between the Shoah as it was and preventing a future Shoah as it could be and it might be. And there is no reason to suggest that people might not wish to repeat that. Again, there certainly are signs of a lot of hatred against Jews, anti-Semitism, and there is a feeling that a Shoah could potentially be repeated if it was not for the Israeli army, and certainly our soldiers are brought up to believe that. And so it's interesting that Ashkenazi also attended a ceremony at Platform 17 at Berlin's Grunewald Station, which is, of course, where the memorial is, marking the deportation of more than 55,000 Jews from that particular station. And the words that he used were, I think, very poignant. I stand here as the foreign minister of the government of Israel and the former IDF chief of staff. Jews will never again be sent to their death because they are Jewish. Never again. That is the mantra. That is the way that our soldiers understand things. And of course, many of them get to visit concentration camps. They go to Poland, to Auschwitz, to understand that the difference between that happened in the past and it's being prevented from happening again is this soldier in his uniform right now, who stands in one hand with the Tanakh or a Bible for those soldiers who are not Jewish, some sort of a holy book, and in the other hand with a rifle to suggest that it's about faith and it's about protection with force if necessary in order to prevent that. And of course, he did mention as well that our sons and daughters stand in one hand with a sword and in the other hand with an olive branch. And I think that that's the significance. And it's going to be interesting to see what Ashkenazi manages to achieve in this visit with his meetings with EU foreign ministers. We do know that Iran is very much at the forefront of the agenda, trying to somehow convince the EU countries to implement sanctions against Iran and not enable Iran's building of the nuclear program. Unfortunately, we don't have a great deal of support at the moment from EU countries, but maybe Ashkenazi might be the one to change their view. But he will plan to be there and also to visit other locations, for example, to visit the 1C villa where the Nazi final solution was actually formulated. So he's combining diplomatic business with some quite poignant and emotional visits within Germany as part of his program.
I just keep thinking of there's a line in davening in prayer, Romemutkel Bigronam, I think Vecherub Bifiot Beadam, or something like that, with the voice with the name of God in your throat, in your mouth, but a sword in your hand. And I think that's
exactly
was that message. Indeed, the Israeli economy shrank more than 10% in the first half of the year, but the forecast for 2020 has improved. just slightly in any event. What are the predictions?
Well, at the moment, the Bank of Israel is suggesting that the shrinkage of the economy, the reduction in the economy, might be as low, and we say low with inverted commas around it, as low as 4.5%, perhaps between 4.5% and 6% for the year 2020. Which, you know, at the beginning of the year would have looked like a disastrous situation, but now with the benefit of 6 months behind us, or a little bit more, almost three quarters behind us, looks like not a bad outcome when you consider that the first half shrank by 10%, and in fact the second quarter shrank by more than 22%. So the biggest reduction, the biggest shrinkage in the Israeli economy in one quarter since the state was established back in 1948, an astonishing statistic. But there are a few positive things that we can take from this. First of all, the fact is that the negative growth figure for Israel's economy seems to be a lot better than many Western economies. For example, the UK economy shrank by 59.86% in the second quarter. The Canadian economy, 40%. The German economy, 34.7%. In the USA, 32.9%. In Sweden, 30%. So these are the negative growth figures that are coming out of other Western economies. So Israel, by comparison, when we talk about the limited shrinkage of the Israeli economy, looks pretty good. But ultimately, it's obviously going to be a down year for Israel. The other interesting statistic relates to the shekel-dollar exchange rate. We know that the shekel has been extremely strong already for a fairly extended period of time. And now it's gone down to it's increased in value to one of its strongest levels that I can remember, 3.40 shekel to the U.S. dollar. Not only has it increased to that level of strength against the U.S. dollar, it's got an equivalent strength against the euro as well. But what's in which has been in a band between 4 shekels to 4.06 shekels to the extremely stable against these currencies. Mm-hmm. Usually we see, particularly in times of volatility, that the currency also fluctuates significantly. And yet over the last few weeks and even few months, the shekel is traded in a very, very narrow band indeed, which is very surprising for all of us who are accustomed to seeing the shekel trading in a much more volatile way. So it seems as if the Bank of Israel has been very active in trying to keep the shekel as stable as possible. And in fact, the Bank of Israel has been quite active in trying to weaken the shekel in order to encourage better exports. They haven't really succeeded in doing that, but certainly a lot of stability at the moment in the shekel around the 3.40 shekel mark to the US dollar.
And finally, a trilateral meeting between Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt has tried to put the focus of the Arab world back on the Palestinians. Why is this considered to be important now?
Been very fascinating to see how the Palestinian cause is currently being viewed in the international press, and particularly in light of the recent peace agreement that was announced between the UAE and Israel. And it seems as if though a lot of the Arab world has decided that the Palestinian issue is kind of not really on the front of their agenda any longer. They don't care so much about the Palestinian issue, which makes me wonder why the Arab world cared so much to begin with. In other words, what was the driving factor? The truth of the matter is that the Arab world is very fragmented, for those people who don't understand it, not only between Sunni and Shia Muslims, but also between different areas, different factions, different sects. The Arab world is a hugely fragmented area, and the Palestinians effectively come very, very low down on the pecking order, except, of course, if fighting their cause has some value to people. And so this meeting that we see between Jordan's King Abdullah, the Iraqi president, the Iraqi prime minister, I'm sorry, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, and the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, was interesting in that they reaffirmed the Palestinian centrality of the Palestinian cause in the Arab world, trying to marshal some forces to try to somehow support this Palestinian cause, which seems to have lost a lot of ground, not only in the international press, but indeed even within the Arab world, where the Palestinian cause was seen to be really one of the things that they were fairly united about supporting, that now does not seem to be the case at all.
Yeah, fascinating indeed, the nuance and the different elements that play a role there. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, this is Where We Love and Leave You. We'll be back with you on a Monday morning, or you'll be back with us, more accurately, on a Monday morning. Hope you have a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, and we'll catch you then.